Thanks, Dan, and good morning. I just want to give you an overview of the previous influenza pandemics, just to put this current pandemic in context. In the 20th century, we've had three influenza pandemics, an H1N1 influenza pandemic in 1918, an H2N2 in 1957, and an H3N2 in 1968. After these pandemics occurred, these viruses circulated as single viruses until the next pandemic occurred. In 1977, we had a reemergence of H1N1, which was a similar H1N1 to that which circulated from 1918 to 1957. And so there was co-circulation of H1N1 and H3N2. In 2009, April, this very week last year, we had the emergence of pandemic H1N1, and we are staying tuned to see what circulates this fall. Now, this is a slide that Fatima Dawood, our EIS officer in the influenza division, presented last year at the EIS conference, and this was the first notification to the world of the outbreak. Novel swine influenza was detected in two children in Southern California, a 10-year-old boy in San Diego County who had mild flu symptoms, but moderate enough to take himself to the doctor. And on April 17th, CDC lab identified swine influenza infection in a 9-year-old girl who also had symptoms that were severe enough to go to the doctor. Both of these children were seen in the influenza-like illness network of providers, and it was because they were seen in those providers that their specimens were sent forward, and these were the first two cases that were identified in the U.S. We, to be honest, in the very beginning of the outbreak, we suspected that these children were sporadic cases, much like we'd seen over the last couple of years, and we went down the rosy path of hyper-investigation for swine contact. In the last two or three years, there were about 12 cases of sporadic swine flu, and almost all of those children and young adults had some swine contact. And so we went poking around in Southern California to find out whether these kids attended any agricultural events, and in fact, the second case, the 9-year-old girl did, and to find out what the connections were between the two cases. These cases were identified, though, within the backdrop of a couple of severe respiratory outbreaks in Mexico. But at that time, we had heard that there were other viral illnesses attributed to those outbreaks, like adenovirus and influenza B. And although it was in the back of our minds, we didn't make the connection that these two cases and those outbreaks were related right away. A few days later, we heard about a couple of more cases in Texas. This is again from Fatima's presentation. At the time that she presented this, it was Friday of the EIS conference, April 24th. It was about 1 week and 2 days to the day after we learned about the first case. We learned about a father and daughter. So the first two cases on the x-axis were the onset of the 9-year-old boy and I'm sorry, 10-year-old boy and 9-year-old girl. The next two cases on the x-axis were a father and daughter in San Diego, so again, a border state with Mexico. The two pink cases are Texas cases, and the last yellow case is a California case who was a middle-aged woman with a lot of underlying chronic conditions. And so at this week last year, this is what we knew about, but we had also heard rumors about cases in six other states. Now, the emergence of H1N1 emerged in spring and summer last fall, and one thing I want to make clear in this presentation is the characteristics of the outbreak in the spring and summer, the characteristics of the outbreak in the fall, and what we're seeing now currently in the winter. This outbreak occurred very late in the spring, and it persisted over the summer, and it occurred outside the usual window of influenza season. Young people were disproportionately affected, and it did cause widespread illness in some communities, although it was extremely focal. And there was some severe disease and there were some deaths. This was socially disruptive, especially for schools, because we exercised a lot of caution in the beginning of the outbreak and made recommendations that schools be closed when there were cases in the school. Those, as we learned more about the spectrum of disease, those recommendations lightened up a little bit. In the spring, we did not attempt to contain the virus. As I said, H1N1 within the first week was already in multiple states and in Mexico. Antiviral medicines focused on treatment rather than prophylaxis. Prophylaxis was only for high-risk people. And we recommended that ill persons isolate and avoid school, work, and travel. And there were recommendations for CDC for workplace cases. Now, this is a map of the United States, and I'm going to show two of these during my presentation, so I just want to explain what it is. This is influenza-like illness reported to the U.S. Outpatient Influenza-like Illness Surveillance Network, that same network where the first two cases were identified. And the areas that you see outlined are core-based statistical areas where we have data coming from providers. Most of these core-based statistical areas in the U.S., of which there are 900 total, are counties, and we have data on 450 to 500 of those counties. Now, the outlined areas that you see in white are places where there were no reports of cases. The outlined areas you see in the very lightest peach are at the baseline, or what's expected, so just a few cases for May of a given year. As we go darker, it's how many cases we saw that were outside the number of standard deviations for that time of year. So this slide was from May 2nd. This was the week of maybe the most hysteria about swine flu. And a lot of people, even very mildly ill people, and even maybe some of the worried well, and a lot of the worried ill going to the providers. But what I want to point out from this slide is you only see red in a few places. You see red in Southern California. You see red in Northern California, a little bit in the Northeast, a little bit in Texas, Arizona. You do see a focus of red around those border states from Mexico. But for the most part, most of the U.S. was spared during the spring, or there were very, very minor outbreaks and not widespread illness. Despite the fact that these outbreaks were very focal, and despite the fact that the clinical spectrum was somewhat mild, there was still overflow in hospitals because people who might not have normally gone to seek care when they have a mild respiratory illness were very frightened and they did seek care. And this slide shows a Texas hospital which had to put up tents outside their emergency department. This same phenomenon was seen in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, and in Chicago, and in some places in the Northeast like Connecticut. Now, this slide gives you an idea. This is from when the outbreak had peaked in the summer. So it's from the very beginning in April to July 23rd. And it gives you an idea of the distribution of cases. At the time that the outbreak subsided in the end of July in the summer, we had case reporting, and there were 43,000 cases reported. And you can see that 61% of those cases, of those reported cases, were in people under 24, with a huge preponderance of cases in the 5 to 24-year-old age group. In the next age group, 25 to 49, 17% of cases, and there were very few cases in people over 50 in general. And this distribution of influenza illness by age persisted not only from the spring, but through the fall and winter, although in winter we saw more cases in people who were slightly older. This slide shows you hospitalization rates from that same time period when the outbreak was starting to subside in the summer. And you can see that hospitalization rates are highest in children less than 4. They're next highest in 5 to 24-year-olds. And then they go down to a pretty low rate in 25 to 64, and then they go up a little bit in over 64. Hospitalization rates don't specifically mirror the attack rates. As you saw from the slide before, there were very few cases in people over 65, but people over 65 tend to have chronic medical conditions, and they had a higher hospitalization rate given their case rate. And finally, this slide from the summer-spring wave. shows you deaths, and you can see that there were, although there was the preponderance of cases in people under 24, only 18% of all deaths were in this age group, and 40% initially were in the age group 25 to 49, and 27% in 50 to 64, and 9% in people over 65. Overall, about 75% of people who died from H1N1, including children, had underlying conditions, severe chronic health problems. Now, what were those underlying conditions? This slide is a little bit busy, but I'll take a moment to go through it, since it was these conditions for which recommendations for vaccination were made. These are adults and children, and in the gray bar you can see the prevalence of these conditions in hospitalized people. The blue bar shows the prevalence of these conditions in persons who died from H1N1, and green shows the prevalence of these conditions in people in the general population. This is a slide for all ages. The slides for adults and children look slightly different, but I'll try and mention that as we go through. Asthma was the most common underlying condition in those people hospitalized, followed by diabetes and chronic cardiovascular disorder. Morbid obesity was also fairly common in those who were hospitalized, and pregnancy as well was common in those who were hospitalized. You can see that both for people who died of H1N1 and were hospitalized, the proportion of chronic conditions were much higher than that which exists in the general population. For those who died from H1N1, there was a preponderance of those with underlying chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and in kids, chronic pulmonary disease, mostly as a result of prematurity. There was also a high frequency of diabetics among those who died, and a high frequency of those with chronic cardiovascular disease, those with neurocognitive disease. Neurocognitive disease and neuromuscular disorders were very common among children who died and less common among adults, given that most of the deaths were among adults, that effect is attenuated. But if you look at neurologic disease among children who died, about 50% of cases of children who died had neurologic disorders, and slightly less than that, about 35 or 40%, had some pulmonary disease. Now, when the outbreak first happened, we gathered around all of our colleagues and we formed teams to investigate the epidemiologic measures. And we were very interested in what the attack rates were, both in households and the community, what the serial interval was, and that's the onset of one case, the time period of the onset of one case to the time period of the onset in a second contact case, and the reproductive rate or the transmission probability, or how many cases one case will make in the community. So let me just go through these measures for a moment. The secondary household attack rate for acute respiratory infection, so not lab-confirmed flu, was 19%. So that means in a household, when there was a case, the attack rate was about 19% for other persons in that household. For those with influenza-like illness, the attack rate was a little bit lower. About 12% of people who were contacts in a household to a case had an influenza-like illness. And many of you know this is fever with cough or sore throat. So acute respiratory infection does not require fever, but ILI requires fever. The community attack rate was developed by doing surveys on the phone, much like we did with BRFSS this year, and calling up people in 10 states and figuring out who was sick in the household. The community attack rate was 47%. The serial interval, or how long it takes from one case, the onset of one case, to the onset of another case, was a little bit shorter for acute respiratory infection than it was for ILI, but it was about 2 to 3 days for both. And the reproductive rate, how many cases one case makes, was 1.3 to 1.8. The reproductive rate is very important because it tells us what the sort of large-scale impact will be in the community. Now, many times, about five times through the pandemic, we estimated the disease burden. And this disease burden estimate was developed by somebody at CDC named Carrie Reed, and it was published in EID a couple of months ago. And what Carrie did was use the results of field studies and of those community surveys to figure out, with multipliers for underreporting and adjustments for how many cases there would be if a certain number of cases were hospitalized, how many people there would be who had infection and how many people who would be which would be hospitalized. And at the end of the spring summer wave, we found that about 3 million people had had symptomatic H1N1 infection, and the confidence limits were 1.8 million to 5.7 million, and about 13,000 or 14,000 people had been hospitalized, with confidence limits 9,000 to 21,000. So this is the total number of symptomatic cases. So after the spring wave, things died down a little bit in July, and we're actually pretty slow in the start of August, and we were scurrying around preparing for fall. And what did we do? We strengthened our surveillance systems. We prepared for vaccination programs. Target group recommendations were made by ACIP. People out there in state health departments enrolled providers and sites, and they planned school-located vaccination clinics. Many communities prepared for medical surge and for impact on business, and we planned for multiple scenarios, for instance, if the virus would become more severe or if vaccine supply just couldn't get out there. The initial target groups for vaccination, as you know, were pregnant women, close contacts of infants less than 6 months old, healthcare workers and emergency medical service workers, children and young adults 6 months to 24, and adults with chronic medical conditions. And the groups listed above totaled approximately 159 million people in the U.S., and that's about half of the U.S. population were recommended for those early vaccination groups. This is a picture of a vaccination clinic, which is for high-risk people only, and you can see people in line, and you can also see the criteria on the sign in the front of the clinic. Now, other interventions that were recommended for the fall were encourage home care for those with severe illness. People were encouraged to stay at home for the duration of fever or symptoms plus 24 hours. School closure for only for excess absence of staff or students, and prompt care seeking for high-risk people so that they could get antiviral medications. Emergency departments developed triage to reduce burdens on facilities and to reduce exposure to other patients. And if you recall that slide that I showed just like this in the springtime, which was very focal, this was the week of the peak of the epidemic. And this is not cumulative. This is just how many CBSAs were affected that 1 week of October 24th. And you can see even in that 1 week, disease was fairly widespread. How widespread was it? Do you remember I showed the slide in the spring of 3 million cases? Well, we had 47 million cases at the peak accumulated over the last, I guess, 6 months or so. 213,000 hospitalizations and almost 10,000 deaths. So this gives you an idea, 3 million versus 47 million, of the magnitude of the fall outbreak compared to the spring. And you'll see in a couple of slides when I show the winter outbreak, we've had not much more disease since this time. Now, what's the current situation? The current situation is thankfully pretty quiet. This is a slide that is ILI visits over total visits for that ILI network that I talked about before. The percent of total visits is on the y-axis, and the week of the year is on the x-axis. And you can see, if you look where it says 5-16-09, we had a little bit of a blip there in early May. That was the slide that I showed you of the CBSAs with focal activity. And then we had that very, very large peak in the fall around October 23rd. This is the largest peak that's ever been recorded in this surveillance system by a lot. The other large peak you see on the slide is 2007-2008, which was a particularly severe flu season, but it's no comparison to this large peak. And now we are down below 1%, which is about the rate of ILI we see in summertime. And we're all very grateful to be down there. This is our influenza activity map that many of you are familiar with. And during the outbreak in the fall, all the states were brown. Now we just have a couple of states, Alabama and Georgia, with regional activity, and Puerto Rico and Hawaii with some local activity. For the most part, folks out in the States are not seeing very much flu. And this is a slide which shows weekly lab confirmed hospitalization rates with the hospitalization rate on the y-axis and the reporting period or the week on the x-axis. You can see that we had large peak in hospitalization rates in October, November. The age 0 to 4 age group was much higher than all other age groups, but now that has gone down to almost nothing. I just want to juxtapose hospitalization rates during the pandemic with hospitalization rates during a normal flu season for all those naysayers who say this wasn't so bad. You can see that during the pandemic, flu hospitalization rates per 100,000 were 83 per 100,000 in the youngest age group. You'll recognize that familiar distribution from what I showed from the spring wave, with hospitalization rates sort of going down as people age, with a bit of a peak in the 50 to 64-year-old age group. But you can see overall that most rates in people over 4 are in the 30s, but the rate in the 4-year-old age group is 83. This is what a normal flu season looks like. This is last flu season, with rates about one half to one-third in that 0 to 4 age group, but about one-tenth in those other age groups, where we have rates of 3 and 4 versus rates of 30, whatever. So hospitalizations were about 10 times greater in some age groups and 2 to 3 times greater in the youngest age group, who always has high hospitalization rates. So that just puts this outbreak in context with a normal flu season. This slide shows proportion of deaths from influenza pneumonia over all deaths. And you can see that we did have a rough patch there around week 40 or 50 where we had some excess deaths, but now those deaths are down to normal, below threshold. And although this outbreak caused severe disease in elderly people, and the numbers of deaths were higher in middle-aged and elderly people than in kids, you can see where we have two earlier flu seasons, 07-08, which was a severe flu season, and 08-09, which was a milder flu season. And then we have the start of the H1N1 pandemic. We had 5 times as many pediatric deaths during this pandemic than we do during a normal flu season. Normal flu season, we have about 70 deaths, and we had over 331 during this flu pandemic. So although the deaths in this age group are not numerous, it is a vast number of excess deaths. And finally, these are the death rates from H1N1. Monthly lab confirmed death rates were high back there in November and have declined to almost nothing now. So overall, just to give you a sort of overview of what we've experienced, and this slide is a follow-up to those disease burden slides, we've had 59 million cases, almost 60 million cases. So we haven't accrued that many cases since the fall outbreak. We have 270 versus 213,000 hospitalizations and 12,000 deaths rather than 10,000 deaths. So since that peak of the large outbreak in the fall, we have not accrued that many cases, deaths, or hospitalizations. Additional H1N1 indicators, the vaccine match was good this year. There was not very much antiviral resistance, and there were no emergence of changes conferring increased transmission or virulence to the virus. The virus stayed relatively stable. We had some selected challenges during the outbreak. We had expectations about real-time surveillance data for situational awareness for not only the federal level, but state and local level. And this was hard for us and hard for all of you. Vaccine production took longer than expected, as you all know, and maybe the messages about vaccine supply were a little too optimistic in the beginning. Now, the potential legacies of the pandemic in the US, we have better diagnosis, we have increased levels of antiviral treatment. We went from 40 or 50% treatment to 70 or 80% treatment in kids. We have more community-level vaccination, including schools and retail establishments. Many more obstetricians vaccinating, and that's a great thing. And we have better links with healthcare, with public health, and local and state federal partnerships. Thank you.